Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
It's a Friday edition of Zero Block 30, and we are going to make you a solemn promise to start out the episode. We are consciously recording before the Mueller report becomes public because there is going to be thousands upon thousands of podcasts, thousands upon thousands of articles written about the Mueller report. You're not going to hear it here today. What you are going to hear about is five rounds that we have in the magazine, and round number one begins with a Korean fatso. That's right, a fatso. He ate his way out of the military service by shoving fried chicken and booze down his chubby little gullet. Honestly, that sounds like a lovely way to get out of serving. Round number two, for all of you who have been waiting, we are going to continue our takedown of CBS's The Code. Those motherfuckers at The Code have no idea what's in store for them for round two. Round three, Iraq looks to ban Fortnite and other video games that have a negative influence. There goes Bryn's summer plan. Sorry, Bryn, you're going to have to pick another game to play. Round number four, the commanding general of 2nd Marine Division dunks his dick on the forehead of every living Marine in North Carolina. He went high and to the right, and it's almost like something I've never seen from a Marine general before. Round number five, Cons has an interview with Dan Fittrell to discuss the Pat Tillman Foundation and Pat's run on April 27th. All of that today is going to be brought to you by
We the People Holsters, who offered custom-made holsters, all approved in the USA. They design their own holster in-house, which means that they don't use any third-party molds for their holsters. Instead, they design every unique mold in Las Vegas in order to best fit each and every firearm perfectly. They constantly update designs, adding new designs every month, which lets them stay up to date on the newest models that come out. We the People Holsters have even designed their own 3D team, which measures the micromillimeter of their guns to ensure the perfect fit. Their unique and intuitive clip design allows for you to easily adjust both the cant and pride of your holster so that it'll fit comfortably and securely at all times. You're able to place the holster on your back and set the cant angle and ride, how low or high it sits on your waist, at which it sits for every single access on your body. Every holster also has adjustable retention, which is signaled with a clicking sound. This lets you know that the firearm is securely in place. If you ever want more tension, you can adjust it and tighten it with just one screw, and you'll be done. Custom printed designs are in-house. They have the thin blue line, the thin red line, the Constitution, camouflage, and an American flag, and more coming out each month. We the People holsters start at just $37 apiece. Every holster comes with a lifetime guarantee. If it's not perfect, send it back for a full refund. Right now, listeners of Zero Block 30 can go to wethepeopleholster.com/ZBT and enter promo code ZBT at checkout and get their first $10 off. That's as low as $37, and shipping is free with an additional $10 off using our promo code, which again is 0BZBT. Again, that's wethepeopleholster.com/ZBT and promo code ZBT at checkout.
Because it is going to be an exhausting several days online. So many reports are going to be out there. Everybody's going to be talking about this and talking about that. I'm glad that we don't have to do it. We're basically doing the podcast version of sticking our heads in the sand and just acting like it's not even happening. I think we're going to be recording while it's released, actually, which is great.
I think so. And you used the exact right word. It's going to be exhausting when everyone comes out with their opinions. It's not something that I'm looking forward to.
Hey, did you guys hear the Attorney General is going to provide an overview of the report before a conference this morning?
Did
and I was hoping we could maybe spend 45, 55, maybe a couple hours on it before we hit the other rounds. But if that's not the vibe, if I'm not reading the room right.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. Let's go into, we're just going to start straight into the episode. Kate, I know that you really enjoy fat shaming, so I'm going to let you take the first round.
I don't, but I will take round one. On Sunday, the Incheon District Court ruled in favor of a 22-year-old college student who'd been accused of eating fried chicken in an attempt to gain so much weight he would be declared unfit to serve. What a power move. According to the Korea Herald, prosecutors argued that the unnamed man intentionally gorged himself on chicken and booze, very much appreciate that, before the physical exam, and then he also made sure to slouch where his height was measured, ensuring that his BMI, body mass index, would be higher. So if you don't know, if your BMI is 33 or above, you'll probably score a cushier job instead of being stuck on a foot patrol or something like that. So this guy was trying to hope at least if he got stuck joining the military, he'd be given like some sort of desk job. At the time of his exam, his BMI was 36.8. So again, 33 or above, not great. And he just argued that he'd been a big boy his entire life. A judge agreed with him after learning that the man had been obese since he was 10 years old. He also said that weighing 225 pounds as a high schooler, it would have been difficult for him to do anything but gain more weight. So interesting. But yeah, there and over there, able-bodied men between 18 and 35 are required to serve for at least 21 months. What do you guys think about that?
I think the mandatory service is fine. What I don't think is fine is the idea of this judge having to judge whether you're getting fat intentionally or not. I think that has to deal with so many things that go inside your brain. But I love the fact that this dude could effectively eat himself out of the military service because we have so many people who've done that. I used to look at Marines whenever they were walking around Quantico and I'm like, you've been in the chow hall already today. I know you're going back for double rats again. I know you want to get out. There was a kid that we had that if I think in the Marine Corps at the time, if you failed two PFTs in a row for being overweight, you get out. Like you get admin set from the Marine Corps and it falls under an honorable condition. Like it's an honorable condition.
Really?
Oh yeah. Army too. It's not, there's no bad conduct.
The military's like, you know what? This kid can eat like a motherfucker. Respect. Like they're just an absolute unit. Go in peace, good sir. Yeah, I respect that.
It's not an adverse discharge at all if you eat yourself out of the military.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that. I thought if you got chaptered for being overweight, that was definitely not, maybe it wouldn't be a dishonorable discharge, but certainly not honorable.
You have in order to get a bad conduct or an other than honorable, you have to be summary court-martialed.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, you're right.
Man, all that time in the military, I never knew I could eat myself out.
If you're that young white corporal who absolutely fucking hates his life and you're listening on a ship and you're like, I'm on a ship, this fucking sucks, we're not even going to any cool ports, head back to the gi-dunk is what they'll call it, the snack bar. Just get all kinds of fucking fried food, get Snickers bars, get Cokes, get sodas, get beers, get whatever. Just eat your way out. Just
eat drink all the sugary drinks in port.
I was
all the
say,
sugary drinks.
What do you guys think you would start eating if I said to you both, all right, I need you to gain 20 pounds and I need you to gain 20 pounds quickly. What are you eating?
I almost did that last month. I gained 10 pounds like in 2 weeks. I could do it easily. I eat chocolate chips straight out of the bag. I pour them in my mouth. I'll eat a whole fucking bag.
No, I'm not saying I believe that you could do it. I'm saying, what would you eat? So you would start with your bag of chocolate chips, maybe some.
Oh yeah, straight to the face, whole bag, and then maybe I'd do crack open another bag, put them on some pancakes. I would just sprinkle those all over my life, and keep drinking a ton of booze.
Mm.
That'd be.
I mean, the most effective way. Whenever I used to try to gain weight, because when I got out of the Marine Corps, I was probably 165, 170. And I always wanted to be a bigger fella. I wanted to be in the 200. Got a little more than I bargained for, by the way.
You did it. Yeah. You did it.
I don't believe that you were more
than I bargained for.
Yeah, you did it.
I think I completely destroyed my internal metabolism because I never thought I would be like 215. So I started drinking these shakes that were whole milk, oats, like just straight up oatmeal, peanut butter mixed in, and then two scoops of protein. So these. Each individual shake would have like 900 to 1200 calories.
Oh my God. Wow.
And I would down those three times a day because I needed to get all the protein, all like the good fats and things like that. I went from like 170 to 205 and pretty built really quickly. If I ate all those shakes and didn't work out, I would have been like the fat guy who sits behind the computer on fucking South Park real quick.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
That's an enormous amount of weight to gain, chaps. That is actually impressive.
Yeah, I mean, now I would, if I was going back now, I would just probably eat just big old plates of spaghetti all day.
Yeah, I think I would just go chicken parm for 2 out of 3 meals a day with some mashed potatoes. And just
I'll call my Aunt Peg. I'll have her send you some.
Can we get Aunt Peg on the horn? I would love some of Aunt Peg's chicken parm.
Oh, yeah. I bet this guy that's in South Korea looks absolutely adorable, though. Like, his little cheeks. I bet he is cute as fuck. Like, you just want to stick him in your pocket. Big pocket, but you just want to stick him in there.
Oh, yeah.
He's probably got baby face.
You need a pair of Jenko jeans with a big pocket, but you could fit them in there if you did it right. I just love that the two ways to get out of mandatory service there are either by winning an Olympic medal, so on the opposite end of the spectrum, being extremely healthy, or being eating fried chicken and drinking booze. Those are the two. You either win a gold or you booze it up.
And there was a dude who recently won they won like the Asian Games for soccer. Mm-hmm. And the guy, if they didn't place first, if they didn't win the gold medal, he had to do 2 years. And he's a dude who's in the English Premier League. And so whenever they won, they started weeping. And it wasn't for the fact that they had won the Asian medal. You know, usually if you win the World Cup or you win the Olympics, you're weeping because you won for your country. This dude's weeping because he's not going to lose 2 years of playing in the English Premier League with all those millions of dollars on stake. He's just like, I don't have to go in the fucking military. I think they should give us that option too. Like they should do like a Hunger Games to get out. That would be so impressive.
Oh man.
If you had like a fight club on base, like Rough and Rowdy comes in, you want to get out of your contract 3 years early. They have best of competitions and you do like a drawing. If you win your fight, you can get out of your contract with an honorable discharge.
Wow. And then that's a great idea. And that would That would follow you that, you know, not only did you get an honorable discharge, but you did it in such a way that it's kind of admirable. So kind of win-win all around. And you probably could televise that as well and sell a lot of tickets and raise a lot of money for veterans. Boom.
That's what I was going to say. Like you could have it on pay-per-view because, you know, people would be fighting hard as they possibly could in there. Give some money to like Headstrong, give some money to other organizations for all that shit. That would be phenomenal. We need to fight our way out of the military. That would be great.
I like it.
I love it. I'm subscribing to that. Let's go.
And for the fatsos out there, they could do sumo instead.
Perfect. So we're not discriminating.
Yeah.
This works.
We don't want a fat shame, so they could do sumo. Just go out there in a big diaper. Good thing.
I love it. Problem solved.
All right, let's move on. Round number two, it's time to dive into the cove. If you've been watching me on Twitter this week and reading the blogs and things like that, you know that I am absolutely triggered about CBS's new show, The Code, which goes into the JAG Corps or the lawyers of the Marine Corps. And the issue that I have with the show is that they almost try to take like infantry aspects of the Marine Corps or big units, like normal units, like artillery, MPs, even things like that, and attach it to the JAG Corps. And that's just not the way that it works. For example, there's a captain who's talking to a young lieutenant who ensures her, I don't know what happened in the show and I will never watch. That's a promise. And I'm making all these assumptions without watching a single episode of the show that something happened to her. Something went wrong. Possibly she got made fun of for being a boot somewhere. And this captain is standing outside in the parking lot of the JAG Corps, which for some reason has a Humvee parked in it too. Like out of nowhere, everybody's walking around in dress uniforms, the service dress uniform. And he says to her, you're not a boot, you're a Marine. And for those that have listened for the show who need a little refresher, a boot is somebody who is junior in grade to someone, lesser experience, or just hasn't been in as long. Like that's what a boot is. There is no time, at no point ever would a senior Marine tell a junior Marine, you are not a boot. That's one of the more outrageous and egregious lapses in Marine Corps culture that I've ever seen on any TV show. Kate, would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. And I can't imagine a Marine having such a lack of a sense of humor that they wouldn't jump on and be like, you fucking boot. Like, I would absolutely double down on calling her a boot. I don't know.
I can't imagine some boot Marine coming up to me and be like, Staff Sergeant, they're making fun of me and call me a boot. Well, it's because you're a boot, bitch. Like, that's the reason why. You're
a fucking boot. I'd say embrace the boot. Embrace it, because it's only going to be for a little while. And then, since you're a badass in JAG, I'm sure you'll see combat soon.
Cons, do you have a boot equivalent in the Army?
You know what's funny, Chaps? I never heard the expression boot until I met you. So, no, not to my knowledge. Nothing I can remember. I'm sure there is, and I'm just not remembering that. But we definitely, you know, have something that where we give a hard time to people. And it's not just if you don't have a lot of experience, you can be brand new to a unit, like you said. And then what I like though was the code at the code CBS, their Twitter, they tried to explain what a boot was as if they were like, oh, we got some inside info. You want to feel like a real Marine? This is how the Marines talk. And it's just completely wrong the way they used it. I thought that was
this
kind of
what makes me think they have a they. So maybe it's not the code's fault. Hear me out.
Okay, it is. But go ahead.
Okay, they tried. Clearly, they have some sort of in on military culture, but I think whoever gave them their resume maybe lied on it a little bit, and I think whoever they hired from the military to so be their go-to.
I have a little inside information about that. People
what?
Have been reading me about who is actually the military liaison. And it turns out CBS has an overall military liaison who is a sergeant major, a Marine Corps sergeant major, and not just a Marine Corps sergeant major, a reconnaissance sergeant major. So he was in recon for almost his entire career, and he is supposed to be the CBS liaison. However, I think what CBS does, they only have one of those people. So they probably don't even have him on every single set, because the bio of when he works for CBS, it does not include the code. How you don't have your reconnaissance sergeant major on set or at least reviewing some of these things is insane, because you would pick up on some of these. Young Lieutenant Harper Lee, which is a shout out to, I believe, To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a pretty strange move. She shows up to her unit in season one wearing a unit citation award and a National Defense Medal. Later on, in the same season, mind you, she's the same exact rank as when she shows up. She then is wearing a Bronze Star with a V, not just one, but two Navy comms, a NAM, and a combat action ribbon with no deployments. She has no deployment ribbons at all. No expeditionary units ribbons at all. But she somehow became a war hero as a JAG officer.
I mean, Chaps, just give everyone kind of an idea of what one would have to do to earn a Bronze Star with a V and two Navy comms.
Well, I don't have that. At all. Like, I don't have a Bronze Star with a V. I don't have a Navy comm. Everything that I did in combat, and I've talked a lot about it on this show, I have a NAM with a V. And for NAM with a V, I found 13 IEDs in a 3-day span, shot up a bunch of people, and blew up IEDs in place and blew up a truck with 500 pounds of explosives on the inside and outside of Karma. So for her to get a Bronze Star with a V and two comms really quickly, it takes some shit to do that.
And that's
God. You guys just can't accept a woman doing her job.
Oh, baloney lady.
Crushing it baloney. Out there.
I have no problem.
Those combat piss test that she's administering.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I have no problem with her being a woman. I have a problem with her being a JAG officer and seeing all sorts of combat. And then they showed one picture. She's outside a Humvee. I don't know when this show is set, but it must be set in about 2003 because the Humvee looked dated as shit. But she was just carrying around a shotgun. That's just not a weapon that a lieutenant would carry around in combat. I had a shotgun that I kept in my vehicle, but that's not like that. That's not the weapon that you carry just on your everyday patrol.
So well, they don't have any – they also – not only that, but they don't have any extra rounds. It's just like what's inside their weapon is what they're carrying. And if something else outside of those, I think it's seven shots.
Oh, my God. You guys just can't accept a woman carrying a shotgun.
Okay.
It's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. But, I mean, you know, Chaps, going back to your military advisor, I mean, it's possible, too. I mean, I don't know. I don't work in Hollywood. But it's possible, too, that he tells them things, and then these writers and these showrunners think, like, eh, that's a little too military for us. And in order to make it more palatable for the majority of our viewers who are civilians, we have to do this, that, and the other. And in terms of the ribbons, my guess is they just kind of look at a box of ribbons and say, oh, that one looks nice.
In proper order. So I don't think that's the case, because there's that have had fucked up orders. These are actually in order, like in how they do it. The other captain, the main captain of the show, he also has a Purple Heart, some Valor Awards and shit like that. And it's just, I like, where are these lawyers going? Like, what
are they doing? These are the most high speed lawyers the military has ever seen. It really is impressive.
I will say, if you're looking to get in the bone zone, gents, I saw a couple photos from in the courtroom. Those Charlies are so tight. There is, I mean, you can almost make out boobs. I mean, is that problematic to say? I don't know. There was this yesterday, because everything the code tweets out goes viral in the military community because we're all so angry at it. So they tweeted this photo of the women walking through the courtroom, and their Charlies are so fucking tight. You can see, you know, those like screaming lines that clothes get when they're super tight.
Yeah.
Like their clothes are just screaming and so tight against their chest that military Twitter grabbed it and was like, oh my God. Because normally it's like wearing a cardboard box.
I think the most trigger that the military community got was this tweet that the code sent out. It says, can Lieutenant Harper Lee balance her duties to the Corps while planning her wedding? Find out in the latest episode of The Code. And she's standing there with like just such a doe-eyed look on her face, like in their freeze frame of it. Kate, how did you feel whenever you read that?
Oh my God. Just because she's a woman, they had to go there. There, I got my third one in of the episode. They had to go there and say that she couldn't. I know I rambled about this on the last episode too, that particular tweet. I looked it up this morning. There's like 50 think pieces written about that tweet now.
Really?
Oh, it's down. They deleted that fucker.
They deleted it.
Oh, I know, because I saw you celebrating that on your own Twitter, Chaps, which I looked you up on Twitter, and then I typed in Uncle Chaps the code, and it is just a barrage of angry tweets from you.
Chaps, I thought you were going to fall out of your chair when they showed the one guy with a haircut. They were asking to wish this guy a happy birthday, and you tweeted, not before he gets a friggin' haircut.
Yeah, I mean, just bad all around.
Chaps wrote an entire blog about it on Barstool Sports titled, "No one wished Luke Mitchell, the star of CBS's The Code, a happy birthday until he gets a fucking haircut."
So, I stand by that. I hope nobody wishes him one at all. I hope the show gets canceled. We're going to keep you abreast on what's going on with The Code, because they pissed me off. You shouldn't have pissed me off. You shouldn't piss me off. Let's move on to round three.
All right, round number three, Iraq to ban video games. Iraq's parliament voted on Wednesday to ban Fortnite, sorry, Bren, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, not sure what game that is, and several other popular online video games due to their, quote, negative influence on a population still reeling from years of sectarian violence. The idea for the ban emerged due to the negative effects caused by some electronic games on the health, culture, and security of Iraqi society, including societal and moral threats to children and youth. The spread of the phenomenon of electronic games is causing violence among children and young boys and girls. The new resolution is absurd on its own, but it's particularly amusing given who's backing it. Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric whose political coalition currently controls the most seats in Iraq's parliament.
And yeah, really quick, that guy who's calling for the end to these video games, that Muqtada guy, he committed widespread atrocities against the country's Sunni minority, in addition to targeting U.S. installations and personnel until American forces left Iraq in the end of 2011. So this is like a fucking not great guy who's like, guys, the video games, but carry on.
Violent. No. That's basically it. So I was just kind of curious, like, do you guys think banning video games has any sort of not even positive or negative, but any sort of effect on
for a country still absolutely just torn apart by this war? I feel like video games are the least of their problems, mm-hmm. and anything causing violence or anything like that, it's not the video games. It's that they say it takes, I think, 3 generations away from war to finally get back to normal life. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that video games are the problem here at all.
Well, there's basically 2 schools of thought on this. I would say that for a country like Iraq to blame video games for their long storied history of violence, it's like, hey, maybe check all the IEDs that are blowing up around you. That has nothing to do with Fortnite.
Well, no. What they're not blaming any of that.
I'm just saying their recent history of violence and everything that's going on over there, like, to blame any of that on video games is just not true. And that goes for pretty much all countries, like, especially in America. When you see games get popular, then you'll have, like, helicopter moms come in and say that my children are getting violent or they're worried about getting violent because of these video games. So that's just simply not true. But I will say that if you're looking for, like, from a military perspective and having, like, you're worried that the soldiers are not going to be, like, of their right minds for war because of video games, I would probably agree with that.
Getting pretty riled up over there, Brent. You're waving your arms around.
I get one opportunity to contribute an episode, and this is right up my alley. So
playing a little too much Fortnite, getting violent.
I think it's just a convenient scapegoat, quite honestly. Yeah, I don't know. Exactly. I mean, I think if you had 100 people play violent video games, maybe you'd have 1 or 2, and I don't know the psychology behind that. I could be completely off. But I don't think playing violent video games translates into actual violence more often than not.
I think it depends on what type of violence it is. If you had, like, a legit thing, like the Call of Duty, whenever they're actually playing in, like, Iraq, Afghanistan, like, looking mm-hmm. environment, that might have a little bit more effect. Because mm-hmm. think about the reaction that happened in America whenever there was a gaming company that I believe was founded in Russia that introduced a school shooting game.
Oh, right.
Like, whenever that type of violence is what's representative of your individual culture, I think it hits a little bit harder to home. So I can imagine if you had American looking dudes in, like, a Call of Duty type game going through an Iraqi looking town, how you could be like, actually, we're not going to do this because this has been going on for the last 18 years. Whereas here, if you introduced a video game with school shooting, people were like, no, we've had enough of that lately.
Yeah, and also I think, and Bren, please correct me, but Fortnite is kind of somewhat has a fantasy aspect to it in terms of
Fortnite's not violent. There's no blood. Like, that's one of the main things that makes it so appealing to the masses, and especially to young children. There's no blood. It's all cartoonish. They refrain from using words like kill. Like, if you quote unquote kill somebody, you eliminate them. They use the terms like eliminate, and they don't use, like, the actual terms for the weapons and stuff like that. They've got all, like, fantasy-ish names for the weapons so that it's not, like,
just goofing. It's just goofing.
Yeah, they're just mm-hmm. it's all cartoonish, so it's not it's really made for kids.
So. Yeah. Honestly, the shocker of the time is that people have strong enough internet connections, because that was not the case.
No.
Yeah. They don't have a very large player base.
Yeah.
Do you guys think, and this is a more general question, do you think our military should ban violent video games?
Hell no.
No.
Do you know that what kind of riot? There would be a mutiny every day when we got released. If we had, like, a lunch break, even if it was like 20 minutes, the guys would scramble back to their rooms and play, what's that fucking Call of Duty? Is that what it is?
Call of Duty or Halo. Yeah, that was the big one.
They could not get enough. And they also had us play simulated video games where you are the terrorist who has to hide the bomb, or you're the one finding it, or where you – so that they had us playing games.
Search and destroy.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, actually, now that I think about it, back when I was in school, the Army was just trying to roll out and try to use video games in more of a simulation and teaching environment. So – is just another way to instruct you on maybe infantry tactics and talking over a radio. So I thought that was productive. I go back to what I said. I don't think that there is a one-for-one correlation with violent video games and someone acting in a violent manner.
Because I, though, think I will that, say,
I think most people's like brains.
That sounds like a ruse to me.
A what?
Like a ruse. Like somebody came up with that idea so that you could play more video games and then pass it off as an excuse that, oh, we're learning military tactics. Is that shit? For all of Call of Duty that I played, I gained no military.
Well, no. It was very specific. It was not a game that was released to the public. It wasn't like a regular video game. It was
like a training simulator kind of.
Yeah, it was more of like a training simulator. Yeah.
I will say, I used to play this game Need for Speed on my computer all the time as a kid, and my favorite thing to do was crush all the street signs.
Yeah.
I would never hit the people, but the street signs. And when I started driving, all I wanted to do for like the first year I was driving was smash street signs. It was like, hold that steering wheel, Bessie, don't.
Well, what I was going to say was also, I think most people with, a pretty normal functioning brain can separate a video game from real life, and then they won't act out what they see in the video game. So, like, Kate, like, you might have had those thoughts that you wanted to run over those signs, but being the normal individual that you are, knew that that was not something that you should actually do.
All right, I knocked over the stop sign on Roland Road. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it.
Tell that to the people that made Her, the movie Her.
Okay.
Just getting a little computer strange. Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, yeah.
Dipping that bad boy. All right,
anyway,
let's move on to round four. Round number four comes straight from the desk of the commanding general of 2nd Marine Division. Buckle up, folks, because this is the most unbelievable letter I've read in a while. To put this, I could see someone saying this shit at a formation, but putting it all out in a letter from the commanding general, not even from like the sergeant major in charge, but straight from the general's mouth, was a move that I don't think I ever saw while I was in the Marine Corps. Here's what he says. Marines and sailors of 2nd Marine Division, in my travels with the Sergeant Major and Command Master Chief throughout the division spaces, I have noticed a significant decline in the basic discipline of our warriors. Because of 2nd Marine Division has the majority of personnel assigned to Camp Lejeune, we will take ownership of this problem and, all caps, fix it immediately. We have allowed Marines and sailors to walk around with long hair, non-existent or poor shaves, unserviceable boots and utilities, and improper civilian attire. There are weeds growing around our buildings and workspaces and trash everywhere, but the dumpster where it belongs. These are just a few of the examples of the lack of discipline seen across the board that will not be tolerated in this division any longer. Our Marine Corps embodies the highest professional standards. How we look in garrison, how we maintain our equipment, weapons, barracks, and workspaces is directly related to how we perform in combat. A general lack of attention to detail and correction of action by peers and leaders results in lower discipline and destroys the foundation on which the Marine Corps was built, ironclad discipline. As leaders, we all need to step up to the plate and reestablish and enforce a daily basic routine, BDR, that promotes habits and thought and action, efficiency and adherence to the standards that are the hallmark of our nation's force and readiness. Part of what makes our forces different from our sister service and American society is a regimentation of our daily lives. Adherence to orders and standards help foster mutual trust in one another and produces the attention to detail required to be effective when called upon to fight as our nation's 911 force. Below is a basic daily regiment that I expect to become the norm across the division. I expect each and every Marine and sailor to fully embrace the following routine. At 0530, there will be a division wake-up reveille supervised by their leaders. 0535 to 0600, hygiene general room cleanup and all blinds will be at half-mast. 06 to 800, physical training, PT recovery, and police call the barracks and commons areas designed for area cleanup. 08 to 08:15, platoon company formation. Leaders use this time to inspect personnel, equipment in the barracks, etc. 08:15 to 12:00, accomplish the assigned morning task. 12:00 to 13:00, we're going to have chow. That's unit dependent. On 13:00 to 16:30, accomplish the assigned afternoon task. 16:30 to 16:45, platoon and company formation again. Pass guidance and direction for the next day. 1645 to 0530. Liberty, it's time to ensure that your uniform and equipment are squared away for the next day. Leaders will inspect their Marines and sailors daily to ensure that the adherence of our naval service's high standards is accomplished and embraced by all. Leaders and peers should not be apprehensive in the correction of other Marines. I love that line. That's a loaded line. Loaded line. Leaders and peers should not be apprehensive to correct other Marines and sailors. Leaders will have full support of the division in the enforcement of this order, as you will be held accountable for the appearance of your Marine or sailor. He's not fucking around. I wonder what happened to get the point where the commanding general releases that letter. Because normally that would come from the sergeant major, like right, as a direction to the other sergeant majors across the base or the first sergeants across the bases. Like, get your people together. Coming from the general, something must have been really fucked up on Lejeune.
This must have been very, very bad. Absolutely. Because, chaps, the fact that a general would write this and not the senior enlisted personnel is just kind of really surprising. Something that took me by surprise, too. I don't know. I guess I've just never seen it. The fact that he was using all caps multiple points during this memorandum was throwing me off a little bit.
That's how you know someone's serious.
And I wanted to give pause before I gave the most unbelievable line that he says. When he closes out, he says, any dissenters can answer to myself, the division sergeant major, and the command master chief, and will be dealt with accordingly. Can each of you live up to the mantra, quote, if I was accused of being a Marine or sailor today, would there be enough evidence to convict me? At this time across our force, I believe the answer for many is firmly no, and it needs to be corrected immediately.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can
this
I
is,
say,
this is bad.
What I just picturing the straw that broke the camel's back, like he's been on base, this general going around for months.
I know what it is for a fact, so I want to see if you're right.
Oh, you do? Okay, yeah. So
no, give your opinion.
He's driving to work early in the morning. He goes by a barracks that has had a party in the smoke pit the night before. There's red Solo cups blowing in the wind, cigarette butts all over the place, maybe even a drunk Marine asleep on a picnic table outside. I don't know. But I just imagine he was driving, he saw something that just made him snap. And now, this is one of those things. What was it, chaps? Like, I'm dying to know.
Well, he was driving whenever he saw it. Him and the Sergeant Major were driving down the road whenever they saw it. It was one Marine with an umbrella. That's it. One Marine with
an
umbrella.
Are you fucking with me because you hate Marines with umbrellas?
Yeah, that's not really.
God damn it. I was like, if that's true, maybe I am wrong about him.
Could you imagine? You see one Marine with an umbrella and you're like, okay, you motherfuckers. If there's any dissenters out there, bring them to me. That's such a Game of Thrones. I could honestly see like the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, like standing up and like, if there's any DeSantis, can answer to myself or Jon Snow.
It was very well written. I liked a lot of the different lines throughout, but I support everything you said, because I can understand how, especially that high up, you're just expecting everything to be perfect. Anytime you drive around, you see anything, nothing should ever be out of order. So,
If you're General DJ Furness, give us a slide in our DMs and tell us what it was that set you off, because I am dying to know. I think
we have more of a chance if you're one of his aides.
Mm.
Up and let us know what it is, because we want to know. I just can't imagine. The Sergeant Major's got to feel embarrassed too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
From the General, the Sergeant Major of 2nd Marine Division has got to be fucking, I would love, oh my God, I'm like getting, my heart starting to flutter just thinking about it, being in the room with all the different base sergeant majors across the different battalions and across the different squadrons on Lejeune, because you know when this came out, he was like every other sergeant major on the base, be in my office in 15 minutes. Like, he was going to go fucking off on all of them.
Because by and large, and chaps, Kate, tell me if you agree, by and large, this entire letter is all NCO business.
Oh, right? Yes.
I mean, 110%.
The general should not be concerned with any of this stuff. This stuff is just some things that should just be happening without second thought. So the fact that he's taking time to call it out.
Dude, I'd be embarrassed if my battalion commander, battalion commander was even involved with the day-to-day planning of anything. Mm-hmm. They have, so you have mission accomplishment is what you're supposed to do, and the command gives you objectives of what they want to see. You have the basically mission intent, like commander's intent of what needs to happen. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, we need to have this accomplished. How that's executed is not up to the officers in the Marine Corps. So the fact that the commanding general of the base is giving a timeline of the day, basically the training schedule of the day, is unbelievable and so far out of the scope of what normally happens in the Marine Corps.
So yeah, we need somebody from Camp Lejeune. You need to DM us and let us know what the heck was going on.
He even says the commanding general, I think was he a 3-star? I don't see what it says his actual rank. He just signed it his last name. The commanding general pointing out in the hygiene room clearing time that the blinds have to be at half mast. I mean, that's what a sergeant says. That's right. like E5 sergeant.
This is where, though, they say, like, all right, you guys were lazy or whatever. Shit's about to get stupid. Shit's about to get real dumb. Because you slacked off, now it's going to be 10 times worse. Now you're going to be up 0530 every day, regardless of what we're doing. You are going to have your room field aid every fucking day, not just Thursdays. You are, blah, blah. Also, I'm looking at a picture of him right now. What jersey is this? Who's the red? Oh, he's a big Ohio State guy. Big Ohio State guy. Here's a picture of him with a high and tight, a football necklace, and an Ohio State jersey on. But he definitely looks like a hardo, for sure.
You know what this actually reminds me of? My battalion commander, who's now, I believe, a 2-star, Major General Tim Daugherty. He used to say, when stuff like this would happen, we would hear from lower leadership that the commander has said he will resort to draconian measures.
Love it.
Yeah.
And he's got a huge fucking stack, too. He's like, this guy, you can't be like, well, this fucking, like, he's never done any, like, no, this guy could, he looks like he could tie you into a pretzel.
Who do you guys think hates reading this the most?
Who do I think hates reading it the most?
Yeah, like when they read it, it fucks up their day the most.
Oh, fucking PFC is like, son of a bitch.
I think it's the senior Lance Corporal who has like 4 months left and he's just ready to get out. He just got back from deployment and he reads this letter and he's like, I just wanted to escape my last couple months. Now we're going to have fucking daily PT. I mean, they're going to have daily PT. They're going to have daily fucking room inspections. I don't know how much generals at that point know how it affects the most junior people. It is going to affect them so much. Like the morale on 2nd Marine Division is going to be at an all-time low. But it also tells me one other thing. This is what it tells me as for my leadership brain. This is what it tells me. If he's doing this, the wars are dying down. This is not something that you do whenever there's high level of tempo, high level mission turnover, high levels of training. The Marine Corps is finally starting to be a turn down in the amount of deployments that they're doing across the board and how much people are actually going out, where the commanding general has time to worry about if people have haircuts. Yeah. That's usually whenever we're at war, the tattoo policy gets a little bit tighter. Like, that's when that happens, because they want us to be clean killing machines. Whenever it's not, whenever we're not doing a shit ton of war, then they'll be like, okay, then you can go look a little bit harder and get your tattoos and shit like that. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening there. The deployment tempo has slowed down, and so now we're worried about haircuts.
Yeah, no, that really is a great point and so true, because there's so many times that little things, as much as they might annoy you, you would just brush off and be like, we're ramping up to go to JRTC, or we're ramping up for that deployment in a month. Like, I'm going to let it slide. But now, yeah, no deployments, hell to pay.
Bring it hell on.
To pay.
Big better time than me. That's all I can say. Better them than me.
And he wants people to like be there and be out there all the time and do the damn thing and be good at their jobs, when he should really just probably go to ZipRecruiter, because ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Hiring is always a challenge, but there's one thing you can do where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, a place where growing businesses can go to connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter.com/zero. ZipRecruiter sends you over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one of the spotlights to the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just the first day. And right now, our listeners get to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free at ZipRecruiter.com/zero. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zero. ZipRecruiter.com/zero. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Let's move on to the interview that Konst did. The lovely interview that Konz did with Dan Fittrell, his former captain, right?
Yes, yes, infantry captain and Tillman Scholar recipient, and he is a graduate of Harvard University.
Whoa, nice.
Cool. Let's listen to Captain Fancy Pants. Here it is.
Pat Tillman. That's a name many of us know but often do not think about beyond Veterans Day weekend in the NFL when his story is told each season. However, his legacy goes beyond being mentioned once a year. Joining us now on Zero Block 30 is an Army veteran who was a recipient of the Tillman Scholarship and is active with the Tillman Foundation today. Dan Fittrell joins us to tell us more about that scholarship and how Pat's legacy is being honored. Dan, welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thanks for having me. Really appreciate
it. Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. So why don't we just start at the beginning, Dan. How is it that you joined the military?
Well, I got to college. I went to college at Gonzaga University up in Spokane. Mm-hmm. Most people know Gonzaga simply in the month of March, but they do actually have a school. And you know, I got there, and I hadn't really planned for a way to pay for school. And you know, my dad had suggested that I join the military while I was in high school, and because it was his idea, I was very much against it. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to college and sat down with the financial aid counselor, you know, she said, hey, here are your options, bunch of loans, work during school or join the military. And this was pre-2001. And I decided that ROTC was the best bet, both for supporting college and for giving me some adventure right after school. And you know, I participated in ROTC activities on campus for the first semester just to test it out. And the people that I met there were amazing. One of the guys who helped run the program, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Westfield, was just an incredible human being and so welcoming. And for me, I thought to myself, if these are the people that represent the military, and I had not been really exposed to the military before then, if this is what it looks like, then I'm all in. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy to join.
Okay, so you served how long in the Army?
I served 5 years.
And then you got out of the Army, and what did you do with your life?
Well, you know, I had deployed twice, both times to Iraq. And on the second deployment, so first deployment was as a platoon leader, infantry platoon leader. The second deployment was as an aide to a one-star. And on that second deployment, made the decision that, you know, if I stay in, I'm going to be home again for 12 to 18 months and I'm going to deploy again. And that pattern of life was not helpful on a variety of fronts. And I know there are a lot of veterans out there who've done that and know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And you served in the Marines, right?
No, actually, I was in the Army. My two co-hosts were the Marines.
You're in the Army. Got it.
Yes.
Got it. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. And,
right.
You know, you and I both know people who have deployed 5, 6, 7 times, I'm sure.
Yeah, that op tempo post 2001 was pretty ridiculous. It was just come home, come home, deploy, rinse, repeat. It was nuts.
Yeah, tough to maintain a life. And
right.
I was in a relationship at the time that you know needed more time at home. And nevertheless, on my second deployment, I decided to apply to grad schools. So I applied to business and public policy programs and ended up getting into the Kennedy School at Harvard for a master's at public policy. And through that, I met a classmate of mine who suggested that I apply to the Pat Tillman Foundation for a scholarship.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about what type of individual the Tillman Foundation looks for when they award their scholarship?
Yeah, you know, the foundation is looking for military service members, veterans, or their spouses who already have a track record of service and a commitment to service, and already have a track record of doing pretty well in their career. And that can mean a variety of different things, you know, and that looks quite different from, you know, an infantry platoon leader to, you know, a buck sergeant in the Signal Corps, to, you know, somebody in a submarine in the Navy, to a military spouse who has, you know, looked after families, looked after, you know, his or her children while the spouse is deployed. You know, one of the things in this foundation was started by Marie Tillman, and, you know, I think she, you know, I certainly won't speak for her, but the foundation really understands the sacrifice that spouses make, and it's been really cool. It's been really cool to see that their sacrifice and their contribution to what is ultimately our national security being recognized through this scholarship as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about making an impact and carrying on someone's legacy. I'm just reading here. Since 2008, the Pat Tillman Foundation has invested in more than 580 Tillman scholars at over 100 academic institutions nationwide. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about people that are really making a difference, and it just seems like that's right in line with the type of individual that Pat Tillman was.
Well, one of the things that has been really inspiring for me, several years ago, I heard Marie Tillman, she talked to a group of scholars before Pat's run in Tempe. I think this was in 2016 or 2015. And what she said, she spoke about, you know, we want to be really, I particularly want to be sensitive, not to suggest that I knew Pat or that I understood who he might be today. But what she said was, you know, people ask her often about Pat's legacy and, you know, what would he be doing today? What would his life have, what would it have been like? And her answer to that was, look at all these scholars and look at the breadth of what they're doing and look at the impact. You know, we've got a scholar who, Kim Young, who started a tea company, who, you know, she would manage the logistics and meet the farmers in Afghanistan and make it more profitable for them to grow saffron than to grow opiates. And through, you know, growing that saffron, she then would connect them to high-end restaurants across the United States and across the world and create that pipeline to make their lives better and to make them you know, less susceptible to you know, influenced by the Taliban or others. You know, she and that Tillman scholar, you know, she's already done her service and, you know, hung up the uniform and is still looking for other ways to serve. And that's exactly the kind of person that I think the foundation is looking for. They're looking for people who have already served but don't see service simply as carrying a weapon and, you know, walking down some street abroad, but it's also a service to our communities locally here and to our country and ultimately the world.
I mean, so certainly making an impact. And you talked about service to communities. Can you talk a little bit about what you've been currently doing, serving your community?
Sure. You know, I've met some folks in after grad school who encouraged me to run for school committee, the local school board here in Somerville, Massachusetts. We're right next to Boston. We've got a lot of the same demographics as Boston. So, you know, over half of our 5,000 kids are free and reduced lunch, so they're living under the poverty line. Over half of our kids they go home to homes that don't speak English in the household. And I've served on the school committee. It's one of the things you had to, it's an elected position, so I had to knock on doors and, you know, kind of share my vision for what schools in Somerville could be. And I've been in this role for 6 years now, and it's been, I would say, you know, I've tried to contribute so much. I feel like I got more out of it than I've been able to give, and I'm still trying hard here. We've really focused our energy on what we're calling a whole child approach to education. So in a local and a state and a federal environment that has, I would argue, overbalanced against math and English standardized test scores, which, by the way, standardized test scores are over 90% correlated with the wealth, the bank account of your parents.
Right.
We have tried to shift that balance more toward the thing that we see that I would say that I see in the military. When I, you know, the people that I knew in the military that did well, they didn't do well because, you know, they got some degree or, you know, got some GPA. They did well because they had emotional intelligence, because they had perseverance, because they, you know, they could take a hit and get back up and keep going. And that, those kinds of social and emotional skills start in first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade. And so it's been really cool to be a part of that here in Somerville, in a community that prioritizes that as much as I do.
Sure. I mean, and you mentioned, so, you know, you're talking about your service. You mentioned the individual who's over, you know, building a business, helping the folks of Afghanistan. Did you feel any sort of obligation because you had the Pat Tillman scholarship awarded to you to serve beyond that, you know, that scholarship, using it in school?
Absolutely. And that's no, the staff of the foundation, and Marie and others, they make it pretty clear that they're not the scholarship that they are investing in when you know we're on school. They're not their main purpose is not to help us get through school easier, though that is a significant value to a lot of people.
Right.
Their main focus is creating a community that has that has a commitment to supporting each other and to having an impact. And mm-hmm. They're pretty clear up front, like, hey, yeah, you're getting this degree, but we want you to keep contributing. And by the way, that's not just an informal, like, that's an expectation. You know, we expect you to keep contributing in some way, and the foundation doesn't dictate, you know, how you might contribute. We've got scholars who studied law. We've got a scholar who is a midwife, and you know, she is leading in her field. And this is, you know, I don't know a lot about midwifery. But she, you know, she gave a presentation one time on what that is and how that's counter to healthcare and pregnancy healthcare in the United States and the benefits that come from it. She's leading in her field. She's leading in a field just by spreading awareness of what she does and the benefits of it. And that's the kind of thing that the foundation kind of holds up high. The foundation doesn't care what industry or sector you're working in, but they do expect you to have a leadership role and to make an impact.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just fantastic that you're making that impact beyond just, you know, getting a free ride to schooling. Mm-hmm. And you guys have a big event. Pat Tillman Foundation is a big event coming up here in about a week and a half or so. Could you tell us about the annual Pat's Run?
Yeah, that's right. Are you running it? Are you running
I will not be there, unfortunately, but I mean, it seems like a great place to be running a race.
It is. So, you know, I'm calling in here from Boston. We just had the Boston Marathon this you know, 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had about, I think, just under 40,000 people running 26 miles. Pat's Run is almost the same size. And I think a lot of people don't know this. It's over 30,000 people are running 4.2 miles in Tempe, Arizona, right around Arizona State University. Mm-hmm. And 4.2 is significant because Pat's number when he was in the NFL.
Right.
And when he was at ASU was 42. And so they have a course down there, and it's exceptionally well run. Everybody's seated. It from a logistical point of view, it's beautiful to see. But the run, and with so many folks, the funds from that run help support the scholars. And, you know, there are a lot of scholars, I'll be down there next week. There are a lot of scholars that go down there and help, you know, just meet folks who have signed up. And, you know, in Tempe, Arizona, a lot of people remember Pat, but we're starting to get to a point where you have a younger generation who maybe aren't as familiar with his story. And what Pat's Run does is it gives us all, it gives the foundation, it gives me as a scholar, the opportunity to talk about his sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his, you know, turning down a multimillion-dollar NFL contract to serve his country and really putting the national good before his personal comfort. And on top of that, what, you know, what a lot of people don't know about Pat is he was an exceptional student. You know, he graduated in 3 years, and, you know, he was the guy on deployment carrying around books and reading them anytime he got a spare moment.
Right.
That's a part of Pat's story that's probably not shared as much, but You know, Pat's run gives us the opportunity to talk about how multifaceted he was,
right?
And how we're trying to support scholars who are, you know, trying to live their life in an impactful and kind of lifelong learning kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, you know, another great way to keep his legacy alive. Actually, Pat's run, it sold out in record time this year, but people can still register for an honor run in one of 37 cities across the country or as a remote runner at patsrun.com. Dan, are there any last words you would like to mention about the Tillman Foundation or Tillman Scholarship?
Yeah, you know, I would say if you're a veteran or if you're a military spouse and you're looking to go back to school, please look up pattillmanfoundation.org. There's a lot of good information there. You know, the run has raises over $1 million annually to fund this. If you're not looking to go back to school, but you've heard about Pat's story and you want to be a part of it, please get on the website and reach out and try to sign up for a shadow run. Like you mentioned, there are shadow runs all over the country right now, and those continue to support scholars around the country as well. So there are a lot of different ways to get involved. So please go to the website, pattillmanfoundation.org, and check it out.
Thank you so much, Dan, and thank you for your service, and thank you for continuing on the legacy of such a great man who epitomized what it means to sacrifice oneself for the country. So thank you so much, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I think, you know, I really appreciate you guys, your willingness to give the run some airtime. I was talking with my fiance this morning. She used to be a Marine. She told me I had to make sure to tell you guys I'm marrying a Marine, and she's always trying to find a way to kind of get one over on me.
Yeah, believe me, I know that
Army thing.
My co-hosts don't let me forget it. So I understand.
Hey,
appreciate it.
Keep it strong,
Connor. All right. Thanks so much.
Look forward to seeing all the good that obviously comes out of Pat's run, which once again is on April 27th. Any save rounds or alibis?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Maybe something we could talk about in the next episode. I did a post just kind of out of the blue, just for fun, like what's the worst military base? And the response to it was huge. Yeah. A lot of people could not wait to dump all spoiler over. Alert.
Lots of them are back.
I was going to say, spoiler alert, a lot of options to choose from.
So like Fort Polk was the top one that I saw, yeah. but 29 Palms, but maybe next week I'll get a little more into it. But it was so much fun reading because I didn't just ask why. I'm like, what's the worst base and why? And people were going.
How about this? If you have a submission, write it into our comments on iTunes and let us know. We will make the announcement of who the worst base is next Friday on the show. So take some time, go forward into our iTunes comment and subscribe 5 stars and say what you think is the worst military base you've ever been on. Cons, what's your save round?
Yeah, two. Number one, chaps, just real quick, going back to the code. If you would like to write a strongly worded letter and complain to Patient Zero, I think you could write a letter to Aaron Sorkin. Because if he had never written A Few Good Men and glamorized military lawyers with Demi Moore and Tom Cruise, I don't think we'd be in this conundrum with the code right now.
Well, the other side of that, if he never wrote A Few Good Men, I would have never joined the Marine Corps. That was the reason why I joined the Marines. Because of the line, the Marines at Guantanamo are fanatical about what? About being Marines. I love that line.
Nice. It is a great movie. And then secondly, I was kind of curious. The other night I was watching Karate Kid for the millionth time, and he gives Daniel a birthday present. He goes out and he says, here, choose one of these awesome classic cars that I have. And I just wanted to know, Mr. Miyagi, Medal of Honor recipient, Mr. Miyagi, where did he get the money to have all these gorgeous cars on a handyman's salary? Is there some sort of pension that you get for receiving the Medal of Honor?
No, but he probably had some good VA benefits. And I also, he probably charged, they don't talk about this, but he probably did some speaking tours and engagement. I mean, yes. If you've been and booked one of those public speakers like Rob O'Neill or Kristen Beck, like they can charge several thousand dollars for it. Also, being a martial arts instructor, if he did private lessons, he could probably pull in some side cash. Probably got Venmo'd under the table.
Also, being a military guy, he probably had them under huge amounts of interest, so it was probably a lot on his credit card.
Yeah, he probably bought them on his star card.
FSMB, Fort Sill National Bank.
Yeah,
but we don't thank Mr. Miyagi enough for his service.
No, we True. Don't. It's a big time mistake. Long time Stoolie Danielson too.
Brick by brick, Danielson.
All right, so I don't have any save rounds. My only save round is I'm excited for Rough and Rowdy that takes place tonight. If you haven't ordered that, make sure you go out and buy Barstool Gold. Get that. Just by purchasing Barstool Gold, you get to see extra episodes of PMT, extra episodes of KFC Radio. You get largest series. You get so much more stuff on Barstool Gold. And getting Rough and Rowdy thrown in for free on top of it is an incredible deal. Make sure you watch that because they are – at least I think they're my favorite things that happen at Barstool. Usually once every couple of months we'll have one. So make sure you go out and buy that. Roughandrowdy.com. Buy RNR.com is where you can get the fight. It's going to be streaming tonight, which is Friday. Get that shit. Sound the retreat.